is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Insurrection, rebellion, coup. All those words have been used for the events in Ukraine, in Russia, in Belarus in these last days. One word that comes back again and again being used now in London, and I believe in Russia, is mutiny. I welcome Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, not only to speak of the mutiny in Russia associated with Prigozhin, the head of the Grupa Wagnera, but also the word mutiny in Russian history and in the history of the last 200 years. Gregory, to generalize, we're looking at a mutiny that leads to what you'd have to say is disaster for the mutineers. This is especially true in the Russian memory, but it also true in the British Empire memory. How so, Gregory? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, in fact, mutinies generally imply a small tactical response within a military unit, which ceases to support the leadership of that unit. In this case, you could even argue that the Wagner Group's action on June 23rd and 25th was not even a mutiny, because it wasn't as part of the armed forces of Russia. They are a separate contractor unit, and they were basically rebelling because they felt that they needed better attention from the Ministry of Defense of Russia. The reality was that the Wagner contract with the Ministry of Defense, or with the Russian government, was about to expire. The Ministry of Defense had insisted that all of the fighters within the Wagner group of contractors, contracted military fighters, mercenaries, in other words, had to sign contracts directly with the Ministry of Defense. In other words, become subordinate to the Ministry of Defense. This would have brought to an end Yevgeny Prigozhin's very, very lucrative multi-year contract with the Russian government, which has made him a very, very wealthy man. So Prigozhin said he would not accept this, and he was going to stage a protest. So this was all understood. The Russian government, the defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, and President Putin all understood that this confrontation was coming. It was necessary. They had to get rid of this special case of Wagner, especially when it required separate logistical lines of support. It was not governable. They were doing their own thing. Yes, they were very effective in some respects, but they were not controllable, and it was becoming a problem which had to be removed. So they put the deadline of it. July 1, all Wagner personnel had to sign separate contracts with the Ministry of Defense. Prigozhin said he would protest. He did. He said he had 25,000 troops ready to back him to protest up to Moscow. He made it clear that he was loyal to Russia, and by the way, that he was still loyal to the president, and that he blamed Defense Minister Shoigu for all of the problems. So that were all well and good. In the end, none of the officers of the Wagner unit supported this protest. And so when Prigozhin made his march to Rostov-on-Don, which was the headquarters of the Southern Military District, which controls the fighting in Ukraine, he had only 4,000 or so troops with him, some vehicles and weapons, obviously, but these were all NCOs and direct combatants, privates, if you like, in the army, in his little army. The Russian armed forces did not stand in the way of his movement. They actually opened the path. They monitored the movement of this small band of, say, 4,000 or so, maximum 4,000 or so of Wagner troops going towards Rostov-on-Don. They didn't block the entry to the city. They cleared the headquarters of the Southern Military District so that there was, a Pyrrhic victory for Prigozhin going into Rostov-on-Don. They didn't want him to go any further, quite clearly, and it was also clear that Prigozhin played too much on his old friendship with President Putin and was unaware that the security forces had basically intimated, look, not only would you and your men engaging in treason by attacking elements of the legitimate government, but your family is also at risk. And that's the ultimate, if you like, chilling thing. So Prigozhin was forced to negotiate. He was never invading Russia proper. He was never trying to overthrow the government, as the Western media has claimed. He didn't have the capability to do so in any event. He hadn't thought it through. He had overreached. He had relied on his friendship with Putin to back down the government, call off Shoigu and the defense ministry, perhaps replace the defense minister, maybe even give the defense ministry to Prigozhin. But that was never going to happen. That was clearly wishful thinking on Prigozhin's part. So Prigozhin settled for what he could. I don't think it's over yet. I think he will ultimately be penalized to some extent. There will be some scapegoats, just as we saw in all of these other mutinies and so on over the years.
Yes,
and
let's go to that record because it's part of your explanation. The Royal Navy, two mutinies, 1918, 1919 at the close of the First War, and 1931 Invergordon Royal Navy. What was the fate of those mutineers?
Well, the sailors who protested in 1919, because at the end of World War One, they were going to be sent to the Baltic, and they didn't want to go, so they mutinied. They were punished. Some of them were imprisoned. Some of them were lost their livelihoods in the Navy. In the 1931 Invergordon mutiny, there were about 1,000 sailors. What was important is that these were members of the armed forces who had undertaken explicit oaths of loyalty to the Crown and their country, unlike the Wagner private military contractors, who were just military contractors, so the violation was less serious. So Invergordon and the 1918-19 mutinies were real mutinies because they occurred within the armed forces. And by the way, we see small mutinies occurring regularly when, a la the Kane mutiny, if you like. But in, World War One, in 1917, at the height of the war, the pivotal time of the World War One, we saw 100,000 French army troops right near the Western Front go into their major mutiny. And that caused many of them to be arrested and imprisoned, and so there were some executions and the like. And we saw, for example, also in 1905 in Russia, we saw a genuine mutiny aboard the battleship Potemkin. And this is this is in 2020 hindsight by the communists and the Soviets, who regarded this as, if you like, the start and part of the communist revolution of 1917. In fact, it really wasn't. It was just an incident which occurred and was quickly put down, but it became symbolic later on. But it was not strategic in nature. One strategically important mutiny which the British saw, the Sepoy mutiny of 1857 to 59, that was a two-year span of mutiny in British India. And it really was quite serious and it resulted in a major restructuring of the way the British ruled India. And bear in mind that it was literally another 100 years, 90 years anyway, before the British voluntarily handed over control of British India to a domestic rule. So the Sepoy mutiny, as large as it was, had no impact on the outcome of rule of British India, just as the 100,000 French troops revolting against their masters over conditions of service in World War One, just as that didn't have any impact on the outcome of the war. So we can read a lot in, or we can read too much if we're not careful, into the Wagner episode, and even to call it a mutiny is to step it up a notch in its credibility. It was a mutiny in a teacup, in a sense.
Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, we're headed to the Indo-Pacific, we're headed to a place called Papua New Guinea, which Gregory knows a great deal about. It's a critical juncture between the People's Republic of China's advances on Oceania and the Australian, U.S., and U.K. AUKUS pushing back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bass.